Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode 11 of the Thesis Driven Leader Series. I'm Brad Hargraves, editor at Thesis Driven, and your host here. And today we're going to really tackle a wide-ranging topic at the intersection of cities and placemaking and the future of the built world. And as a guest, we have Stephanie Blake, who has built a business. She's the CEO of a company called Skylight. And what Skylight does is they help activate places for developers, for governments, and for brands, and bringing all these pieces together to help really bring people and bring vibrancy to places that might not otherwise have it. So why does this matter, and why are we talking about it? Well, one of the things that developers always try to figure out and cities try to arrive at is, how do you create better places for people? How do you bring people together, and how do you activate places that might have great bones but might not be a natural place for people to congregate? One example is an activation that Stephanie did at Moynihan Hall. This was while the state government in New York was trying to figure out what to do with this old post office while they were turning it into a new expansion for Penn Station, where Amtrak now terminates in New York City. And through that, Stephanie and Skylight were able to bring a lot of different pieces together to help activate that space. And they did that in a number of places. They did that at Michigan Central Station in Detroit, and the Ferry Building in San Francisco. And we'll hear about some of those stories. And through that, we'll learn how she and her company kind of works this magic to bring people together and placemake in new spaces, and in some cases, in very old spaces. So really excited for this conversation with Stephanie today. I think we'll learn a lot about cities, a lot about economic development, and bringing all those things together. Let's jump in. Stephanie, welcome to the Thesis Driven podcast and video series. So excited to have you on the show today.
Brad, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to chat.
So we talked a little bit in the intro about some of the great projects you've done. I mean, you've worked on Moynihan Hall, the Ferry Building in San Francisco, the High Line in New York. So tell us about your favorite project and kind of how you got involved there, and tell us, just so people get a sense of like what your work is, what it entails. So pick a project and just tell us the story.
My favorite project, hands down, has been Moynihan Station. I think it was a really under-recognized sort of hidden gem in the middle of Manhattan, one of the greatest cities in the world, and no one really even understood what it was. And we came in under Governor Cuomo now over, you know, almost 50, a decade ago, before the revitalization. And at the time, it was still a functioning post office. It was built as the sister station to the original Penn Station that was demolished when Madison Square Garden was built. And it's this cavernous, amazing, obviously, Beaux-Arts building. But the beauty of it was such that only 8 or 10% of it was still being used as an active post office. And everyone had said, hey, you need $10 million before anyone would even set foot in here to do anything. We walked in to the mail sorting room with these amazing 60-foot ceilings, the black resin floor, these catwalks, pigeon shit everywhere. But it was amazing. And we were like, this is a gem. And as we explored it, there was the mail sorting room. There was also the postal dock. There also were tunnels that go under the city of New York from 33rd and 8th Avenue all the way to 29th and 10th Avenue, because that was where the packages and parcels building was. So when goods and jewels and all the things would come across off of the Hudson, to get it safely to the mail and to the actual post office, you had to travel underground. So it was this amazing discovery. But for us, you know, I think the beauty in it was, wow, it's not being used. There's 2 million square feet in the middle of Midtown. How can we activate it? And we were immediately drawn to think about what are the types of events and activations that would use this to its fullest, to celebrate the history, the architecture, and what it is. So that project for us, I think, taking it on before Vornado and Related got involved, before really the city sort of was aware that they knew that this was a project that they were trying to get funded to revitalize it, to make it the train station that it is today. But at the time, they weren't sure of the course to get there, and they weren't able to get the interest and the funding to do that. So for us coming in, doing things with a brand like Nike, who took the facade of the post office, neither sleet nor rain nor snow, you know, nor dark of the night will hold our couriers back. It became their New York City slogan when they launched their athletic wear line as one of the first activations we did there. And they said, neither sleet nor rain nor gloom will hold our athletes back. Hmm. And thinking about how brands can take the context of history, do something incredible there. And then fast forward, we moved New York Fashion Week from Lincoln Center there, zero renovation. But these brands, wow, and these, you know, artists and creatives saw the potential of the skylights, the cavernous ceilings, the catwalks, and it became this moment of, wow, this is a historic building that's been so underutilized. How do we celebrate it? And how do we bring energy and activation and actually draw the crowds to celebrate what the potential could be? So fast forward, Vornado and Related, you know, became interested. It's now this $3 billion redevelopment. And Vornado has brought Skylight back to the table to be the placemaking partner for the district based on the entire sort of Penn District redevelopment. And we have two state-of-the-art venues that we are now opening, one in the very next quarter of this year. So that arc of sort of identifying a building century years, you know, over a century old, and then coming in, infusing that energy, generating revenue. We were able to generate over $17 million with zero investment there. And then to sort of come back in its final form as it's sort of moving into modern context, that to me was hands down one of our favorite projects.
That's awesome. So you were initially, your client was the state, the government.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's, I think it's one of the really unique things about your business is you're working, you know, not just with real estate developers, you're also working with public sector actors as well, because Moynihan Station at the time was kind of a decrepit building in a weird part of the city.
Totally.
You know, the back end of Penn Station is not exactly what most people think of, certainly not 10 years ago what most people thought of as like, yeah, that's the hip and happening part of New York.
No. And I think the beauty in that also was because we were able to bring, you know, some of these brands, designers, creatives that see these ephemeral activations as a one-off, they are also seeing the story and the soul. And so I think when Architectural Digest wrote about the Fashion Week shows and the beauty of the skylights, there was this kind of additional desire to retain that. So I think there became this desire to not just revitalize, obviously it's a landmark building, but also to celebrate some of the things that these brands through experimentation and sort of proof of concept showed value in. And I think that's something that's also part of our business, which is, you know, we see these underutilized buildings and oftentimes, you know, there's the desire to just build it and, you know, work with architects, design it entirely. But I think the way that the world's changing so quickly these days, often bringing in interim activation to inform how the space might be used, what types of flexibility, you know, who might be attracted here, what the storyline can be, but also just the programming of the space can be informed by that initial activation.
So I want to talk a little bit about that and make sure we really hone in on the value proposition. Because we talk a lot about placemaking at Thesis Driven. We've done some, you know, deep dives in our newsletters into developers who are focused on placemaking, and activation is obviously a key part of placemaking. Mm-hmm. So when the state is coming to you, when Vornado is coming to you and saying, hey, we want to activate this space, what specifically are they looking to get out of that?
There are a number of different objectives that activation and placemaking through activation achieves for either the state, city, or developer, landlord partners. You know, starting with ground zero, when you're looking to activate, generate exposure, build identity, there's so much that by bringing in a brand or an amazing activation, you create a storyline, you build identity very organically. You're also generating revenue. Like the beauty of Skylight's business is we're not just a solution that's marketing driven, but we're also a business plan. So when we bring, we often discuss our business as, you know, it is a dual-sided business, but ultimately we are partnering with real estate to provide a product. However, the brands we're working with see our value as providing access to what is otherwise inaccessible, because these types of underutilized buildings like Moynihan, no brand can go in as a one-off. And also they wouldn't want to, because our role is to develop a venue that is non-traditional to provide the structure, everything from permitting to structural engineering to all the pieces that go into a venue that is unique, that might be under construction. One of my favorite memories of Moynihan is flying in the VP of Fashion Week from Berlin to walk it. We were under an asbestos abatement. We hadn't had the EPA clearance. We had to zip up in hazmat suits to walk the building to identify what we were going to do. So there's a level to what Skylight does where, you know, there's this like, we can come in under the craziest of circumstances and identify that canvas and move through the project to then also provide that final use where it is a state of the art venue. And so I think initially it's some interim revenue, like a lot of our role, even on the west side of New York, pre-Hudson Yards, pre-the High Line, was, you know, 2008. We were born out of the recession in 2008 to come into buildings and provide a cash flow. It keeps the lights, it's paying. There's so many costs that go into a stalled project, right? Carrying costs of what a building is. So if we begin to come in and generate a few million dollars or whatever it might be, even if it's not going to be that final end use for all the square feet, it's really providing value then. I think then fast forward, you know, when it's buildings and districts that are trying to get leased or that are trying to retain tenants, our value there is also in being able to attract, especially these days when companies and brands are shifting their relationship to real estate. It's not just, hey, we have 500 people that are joining the company. Let's take a formula and get that many square feet. So for us, it's how do you actually attract? We work with brokers as well. How do you attract some of these brands and companies you want to get on site? Because as we know, real estate is so physical. You need to be there to understand the value of it. So a lot of renderings, you can do so much. But so a lot of our value is also, how do you get some of these brands that might not pay attention to it because they're not looking actively for real estate in this way to come on site and then to see the potential, even to get brokers and to get other sort of, you know, there's a very traditional way of marketing real estate. And I think our role and value to the sort of the city, but also to a lot of these lands and developers is actually to get interest, get people on site because of the value of what events can bring in terms of engagement and attraction.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about how you got into doing this. You were a history major at Yale, correct?
I was.
So one of the interesting things I saw when, you know, I was reading a bit about your background, as you mentioned in a Real Deal article, that your history degree is actually really helpful in what you're doing today. Tell me a bit about that.
For me, history is all about story and context. And when, you know, Skylight's, our ethos is really, you know, these underutilized gems and identifying the story, the soul, and bringing it to life in modern context. And I think bringing buildings into the 21st century and the buildings we're attracted to and the projects we're attracted to, it's all about sort of what was there, the idea of adaptive reuse, a purpose-built structure being brought into the 21st century. And I think, you know, that's why our business has been really successful in aligning sort of brand interest with real estate or developer interest, because when a brand or a company can understand the story, in addition to the architectural elements and all the pieces, but that part of kind of why something was built, the history of the neighborhood, the history of the city itself, that's what creates an unforgettable event or a moment. You know, when as human beings, we appreciate story, we appreciate where we've come from. And I think there's this added element that is really critical to the venues we build, which is bringing that story forward. And so I think for me, that's where, you know, my interest in history is very relevant to what I do now.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the best implementations of whether it's adaptive reuse or placemaking tap into the story of whatever place they're in, and not just tap into that story, but put that story in context. So exactly. I love that connection and you know, being able to do that. I think a lot of people, you know, denigrate the liberal arts degree, but I think kind of doing what you're doing in real estate kind of speaks to the value of it. I do want to talk about how you got here and how you got into doing it, because I feel like I look at what Skylight does, I look at what you're doing, I look at the kind of implementations, activations you're working on, and I feel like this is what a lot of architects and designers who are just starting out want to do. And, you know, it's like the good and fun parts of architecture and design, and not the like repeated iterations of value engineering that is actually involved in architecture and design work. So tell me a little bit about kind of your how did you start doing this? What was the path from, you know, I'm a history major at Yale to I am not that long doing an activation at Moynihan?
It's so interesting. I think it's putting my career in context. Like, it would have never made sense what the progression is had I sort of started from being history, which I wouldn't have known I could have ended up here. Moving out of, it's interesting also that you say people denigrate the liberal arts degree. My parents are first generation from Jamaica. History, what are you going to do with it? So I did take a job at Google right after Yale. And what I loved about Google was the community that it provided. It was still where, you know, everyone was on campus and it was this extension of college and all the pieces. But while I was at Google, I actually took a job at the same time at a restaurant. I've always been drawn to environments, what it means to provide hospitality, what makes an environment engaging and exciting, and also the different types of intelligence that are in different industries. And I think that by working at this restaurant at the same time as Google and learning a lot from being at Google, and it was at a moment where we were just convincing advertisers to move online in a really big way. You know, we would show these charts of here's how much is being allocated to TV and radio and print, and here's where online is so much more effective, which feels crazy now. But when I met Jen, the founder of Skylight, I had already known that Google wasn't going to be it for me. I didn't want to be part of, you know, this large company forever. I knew I had an entrepreneurial spirit. I loved working at this restaurant. I would work the restaurant and go out till 2 and be back at Google, but really was having much more fun and just feeling activated by being in a different industry. And so I think the progression then was such that, you know, Jen had done this with, you know, really just thinking about one, it was Sky Studios. It was one sort of penthouse environment that she sort of began to do events. And then as we sort of met and talked, you know, we began to think about what does it mean to create a blank canvas? What is happening right now with underutilized real estate? How do we think about, and, you know, she'd already done this parking garage and we were looking at this big warehouse, and it just became this moment of, wow, like how interesting to see marketing budgets growing. It was at a time where entertainment was at its all-time high in New York City. And we were able to move actually Ralph Lauren from the Upper East Side and his, you know, clientele and a Bryant Park to this warehouse to do his shows. And it was this moment of Ralph Lauren taking over this warehouse on the west side of, you know, Dominic and Spring in downtown Soho, but West Soho, where no one was going over there. And to see the progression of what someone would be able to spend, what you're spending 3 weeks to build out for 2 20-minute shows of, you're spending $10 million on 2 20-minute shows. But the value of the experience and understanding that, you know, for me, it was this weird sort of kind of moment where I saw real estate as a canvas, the way that online was this canvas. And so to begin to think about real estate as this ability to be this additional component of how brands and companies will spend and how they show up, that was sort of a connection point. But I always knew that Google wasn't going to be my end point.
I think this is fascinating, just looking at the spectrum of like online to offline, because you effectively went from evangelizing the most online, most scalable, most anonymous in some way form of, not that Google is really anonymous, they have plenty of data on us, form of advertising, to the most high touch offline. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think there's this kind of like the ends, the barbells make sense. Like you can use very scalable online advertising, or you can do something really high touch, really experiential in person. It's the middle stuff, you know, print, TV, radio, that's just gotten hollowed out.
I see space for all of it. I think if done in an artful way, I do think advertising is always this mix of art and science. I think in particular right now and what COVID taught us, you know, one of our very first activations during COVID was with Netflix. Netflix, who at the time was, you know, everyone was consuming so much content online and streaming every show and meeting with Netflix, and they partnered with us to their first drive-in to experience. And that was in LA on this 32-acre district called The Row. And working with them, it was so interesting to see this company that at the time was really benefiting from obviously being this online content platform, but recognize the value of bringing people together. And I think that there's so many touch points for how to connect with a consumer. And as much as this world right now, to your point, is so oversaturated now with digital, I think there is this kind of retreat and desire for the tangibility, not just of being together, but to, you know, I think of Cultured Magazine, some of these magazines that now have these beautiful print spreads and are growing exponentially, obviously a bit niche, but I do think there's space for it all. And as human beings, I do think because we have a physical body, we are also still drawn to what you can touch and see and feel. And right. So I don't know. I think it's similar to maybe even like the office crisis, like there's a flight to quality. So I think to be in that hollowed out space, you have to be doing it really, really well.
Yeah. So let's talk about doing it well. And let's, you know, as much as I would love to host a media podcast, this is a real estate podcast. A lot of our audience are real estate investors, developers, entrepreneurs. So I want to make it tactical and helpful for them. So, you know, you've done a wide swath of spaces. I'm sure you get a lot of inbound from various places, from people who want to work with you on the activation side. What makes for physically, from a space standpoint, what makes for a good activation?
What makes for a great venue opportunity in any stage of development is flexibility. The bones are critical. So high ceilings, higher than, you know, 12 feet is very helpful. For us also, the caliber of what we want to achieve, I think having more than 10 to 15,000 contiguous square feet is our ideal. Also not being overly prescriptive. So I think providing, again, the flexibility and modularity of a space where, you know, we might, if we can knock down some walls and create sort of the larger canvas, I would say, you know, a bit of a storyline, even if it's new construction, being able to extend the canvas to understand why is this building going up right here? Who are the neighbors? And not just sort of developing in isolation. I think that also makes for a great activation, because the way that Skylight functions is we think about our role, not just the venue with the four walls and the ceiling, but how does this canvas work in terms of, is there a coffee shop? Like, is there, you know, an alleyway? What does the streetscape look like? What are the other businesses in the area? And how do we create an activation that actually incorporates the sense of place? On the flip side, the value also of activation is we can create a destination. And I think the beauty of, you know, coming out of COVID with this new question mark of what is the future of downtowns? You know, what is the future of some of these built environment that just, there was never a question prior. We can create a destination without the rest of the ecosystem coming back. So I think if there is a lot of vacancy in an area, identifying for us, we like to identify that maybe the space that has the most potential in terms of what I shared about the bones, but also it's interesting to see how we might expand. Because when we work with brands, the budgets they have, the expansiveness with which they're thinking about what real estate means to them, we can connect with a core, maybe heartbeat of a space, and then create something that expands over a neighborhood. So I think that piece also is important.
Yeah, I think one thing, and I mentioned this earlier in the intro, I do want to make clear, is like, you're not just activating a space. You're also putting dollars into the developers, the manager's pocket, because you're bringing these brands in. And I do, go on.
Oh, go ahead. And in addition to those dollars, a lot of what we've tracked has also been the dollars we're putting in the neighborhood businesses. So when we have activated in certain spaces, we actually tell the coffee shop, the retailer, that we're having, you know, Nike's biggest thing, we're having Hermes, we're doing this fashion show, because the amount of traffic that then comes in terms of making a destination, they have to staff up. So I think there's a beauty also in the economic benefit of the sort of circle surrounding the radius surrounding that building itself.
So I do want to talk about COVID. You mentioned COVID earlier. I want to hit on kind of the pandemic that has had huge impacts on a lot of the central business districts where you do your work. But I want to keep it tactical for a second. So you see a space, a developer comes to you, they have some space they want to activate. They're doing a placemaking project. What are the things that make you say, "Ugh, I wish they hadn't done that"? Or on the flip side, if they had done this other thing, this would be way easier. We'd have way more brands interested. This is going to be a hallmark project for us.
The biggest challenge that we see is being overly prescriptive and trying to design a space for the desired use from the outset without.
Can you give an example? Can you give an example of that, just so we understand?
Absolutely.
What you mean,
designing a space out where you're trying to create, you know, the pre-built office or the pre-built auditorium, where you put in all the state-of-the-art speakers and you put in all the screens and you spend so much money on the technology that's like outdated like that. There's so much value in, if you don't yet know exactly how the space will be programmed, to working with a company like Skylight, because there are so many vendors that on a temporary basis can put in that state-of-the-art technology. There are so many brands that will inform how that space can be used and make choices, be it from a design point of view and technology and from purely even FF&E. There's so much that can be reaped by thinking about how do you offer this up if it's not yet a pre-leased space? And I think in particular, the technology piece is one that I know everyone is so focused on these days, particularly with needing to be connected and provide the remote and the hybrid piece. But a lot of that I've seen, we have to rip out when we come in and it was just put in a year prior, or it doesn't function in the way that this particular company wants it to function. And we've been in, I won't name the development, but we've been in spaces where that's happened. And our role, we actually do work closely. We were brought in to projects with Foster and Partners, a few other architecture firms, and our role is to help inform the design. And I think architects, we are not architects. Architects are incredible and they're amazing, but the way that we can work with them based on, from 2008, we have thousands upon thousands of floor plans and builds showing what the top Fortune, probably the top five companies, you know, in the world have done on their top 1% of their events. So being able to use that to inform what you're designing and how you're designing, I think that's probably one of the biggest things. I would also say, you know, designing something, one thing I've seen with a lot of landlords and developers, they're not always thinking about the context of the neighborhood. And I think that's something really important. It's not a silo. And if you want to create like a self-sufficient building these days with amenitization, really think about the way that a lot of companies are thinking about an urban campus when they do move back into a downtown. Your building itself, it's really important to think about what else is being offered or already exists outside of your building.
Yeah. Let's talk about the pandemic. Obviously, a lot of impacts. There was kind of the near-term impact of it, shutting down a lot. And then kind of this chronic, it seems like, impact of people working from home, people not coming back to those central business districts. How has that impacted your work? And how has that changed the type of projects that are coming to you?
A lot of the brands that we work with and worked with prior to the pandemic were some of the most innovative. I think we're very lucky to have carved out this niche business where, the way I was speaking about earlier, we provide access to what otherwise might not be accessible. So the brands that we work with are always coming in and trying to be innovative and thinking thoughtfully about what is the future in a way that I think, no offense to the developers and landlords listening, but sometimes real estate has to catch up to that, especially as the world starts moving more quickly. And ultimately, what COVID taught all of us is you can't compete with someone's home, but you don't want to compete with someone's home. As human beings, we all desire a third space, right? Or we all desire that second space. There's different functions and a different objective for the workplace than your home. So the value of activation and a lot of the value of what Skylight's provided in terms of the venue being this new anchor of development or an amenity for a building or a district is how do you provide something that people can't get at home? How do you provide community? A lot of our work with TED, for example, bringing storytelling and some of these conferences into buildings as an amenity, encouraged not just companies to come back and provide that as a but also the interaction between companies. And I think we saw that even pre-pandemic, where, you know, my former employer, Google, like a lot of these companies that built these campuses were starting to recognize the value of the exchange of ideas between other companies. And for us, COVID impacted us, of course, initially. It was a very scary, like, what's happening? Everything shut down. But working, for example, with Netflix, as I mentioned, we saw that our partners were not going to be, you know, just completely stagnant. And they looked to us to continue to be innovative in ways that all of us, our core belief and the brands that we've worked with for many years, believe in the value of coming together in person and how to do that in terms of the shared experience and what that means for just humanity generally. And I think that's what everyone in the built environment, developers, architects, what we all love is you're building a space for people to come together. And that's something that will never go away. And I think COVID just did provide that like flight to quality, but also how to be more innovative in what that means and why people will get off their couch.
So you're a big office owner. You know, you're seeing lease terminations come up. They're rolling, you've got increasing vacancy. How do you, you know, how do you play this? How do you use the lessons that you've laid out here to bring people back and make these vibrant spaces again?
It's tough. I think the lessons that have been learned from COVID is you do have to provide something that is distinct and unique and engaging. I would also say that there's value in really being thoughtful as to how to partner with your tenants. I think real estate, we saw prior to the pandemic, and for a long time, it's felt very transactional, the relationship between the tenant and the landlord. We were brought in to do this global blueprint for placemaking with Brookfield pre-pandemic, but it worked through the pandemic, where we took 10 different assets and different phases of development and really worked with their data teams, their marketing teams, their leasing teams, their asset management teams to determine what is the value of placemaking? How do you invest in it and what does it mean? And I think what came out of it was the value that we provide as Skylight in a very much a venue development company that sort of organically become a placemaking firm is the conversations that we have with their tenants. So when you think of a big office building and the challenge of either retaining a tenant or getting others to be interested, there's a lot of different bottom lines for businesses these days. And there's a lot of different ways that businesses see the value of real estate. Is it providing an amenity space where they can do the panels that they need to do as a media company? Is it, right, you know, providing, I know, you know, no one's not thinking about podcasting, but what are the value points within your building that help the business or your end tenant's bottom line? And then what are they challenged with? Is it that they have employees of X demographic that need to come back? And so you're looking to provide more programming that might be more social or more educational. And I've seen success in some of these larger office buildings by not just building an identity in terms of the architecture and the beauty and whatever it might be that they're the biophilic, but like, what's the identity? Are you trying to create a mix of law firms? Are you trying to create a mix of like, what is that? Because I think that's, again, where programming is the heartbeat of a building. It's an organism. So if you can be a bit more thoughtful around who you're trying to attract and why, that's, again, where community very generally makes sense. And we've had success with that in districts, thinking about that and providing that as an organizing principle.
I want to talk about another big trend that's happened a lot since the pandemic, which is the shift toward experiential retail. And this was started well before the pandemic, too. I mean, shift to e-commerce, a a lot of retail spaces, a lot of retail entrepreneurs said, hey, we have to create a more experiential environment to get people into the store, to get people to spend money here. You know, I'm curious your take on that. I mean, a lot of your, you know, implementations, activations happen in kind of retail-like spaces. So do you think things are going to continue to trend kind of in a more experiential direction in retail?
I do. I think it's experiential paired with some of the analog. And I think experiential can feel like it's only the Van Gogh immersive or the, you know, the very sort of tech heavy or more immersive of an experience. I think that it's really about the experience being a bit more holistic and also for a consumer thinking about that lifestyle approach. So I think there's a lot of collaboration happening in experiential retail where brands that you might not think would even pair together are coming together because they're able to expand their communities and connect their communities. And I think that's something that's just becoming more and more the spirit of collaboration and what that means for a coffee shop to be there with the retailer, with the perfume, you know, to think about how you're creating almost like a one-stop shop, but in a way you're also curating the experience of, hey, what am I going to do at 9 a.m. all the way till 9 p.m. and that happening in experiential retail. I would say the reason also a lot of our activation spaces have been, you know, maybe retail adjacent type spaces is we really believe in the value of the ground plane. And I think the other piece that's happening with retail is how do you expand onto the sidewalk? How do you expand to sort of connect with your neighbors or what's across the street? And so again, thinking about sort of the context of what is around you for retail is not going away and it and should be something that both landlords and tenants are thinking about. And I come back to the concept of community. I think that is where there's success. I think it used to be there was the ability to have one department store or one thing and that was successful and purely suggestions. But now there's just so many ways to transact that what you're offering has to be an experience.
Well, one of the most interesting things I got out of the deep dive that we did for Thesis Driven into placemaking this past summer was this idea that great placemakers plan, as you said, kind of not just in the physical realm, not just on a physical axis, but temporally as well. You have to think about what's happening at 9 a.m., what's happening at noon, what's happening at 6 p.m., what's happening at 10 p.m., because especially if you've got to support retail tenants on site, you can't just have a burst of people show up at 5:30 and then leave. That doesn't work. So, you know, I was talking with Devin McCorkle, who runs Miami Freedom Park. They're a really interesting placemaking development near the Miami airport, anchored by the new Miami FC stadium. And he's got this really interesting problem to solve of, okay, you're anchored by a stadium. You've got maybe 4 nights a week where you just get a flood of people for a 4 or 5 hour period. What do you do outside of that? How do you bring people to a place like that? So I love kind of what you're saying in terms of thinking about the time axis as well. I think that's one of the things that good placemakers, people who have done this before, do very well.
Experiential is pushing into a way where these types of formats, like a stadium, like the parking lot that is the stadium, there's so many uses, right? We started out now 12 years ago with the very inaugural Brooklyn Flea at the Clock Tower building in Fort Greene, right? The historic Williamsburg Savings Bank. And now Brooklyn Flea and Smorgasbord, we did all of those inaugural things. And then now we work with them at the Row in downtown LA on the parking lot that is. So there's this, you know, craft fairs with the makers. There's so many things that actually can command a larger audience these days that can still repurpose an existing format like a stadium or like a district. Yeah. And I think we think a lot about adaptive reuse as only being in the context of how do you take something that was built for some purpose 100 years ago and change it today. But I think there's a lot of different types of uses for purpose-built things for today. And that's where we specialize, is to think about exactly that challenge.
I do want to talk about, you know, speaking of taking a project and something that was done for a different purpose 100 years ago and changing it into something today. While a lot of your work has been in New York, SF, DC, or LA, You did a really interesting project in one of my favorite buildings in Detroit, Michigan, an activation at Michigan Central Station there. Would love you to tell a little bit the audience a bit about that.
That project has been one of our favorite projects also. We've actually been working on it for the last several years with Ford Motor Companies in terms of what this legacy project is for them to Detroit. And a lot of our work there was initially based on even what I've shared in this podcast is looking at the ground plane, looking at the indoor, the outdoor spaces, and thinking about how activation can inform the future state. They have very clear principles as to what they're trying to do there. It is an innovation center. They're focused on sustainability, mobility, community inclusion, as well as education. And one of the first activations we did there was the TED Climate Summit. And TED, of course, is a phenomenal partner in terms of storytelling and education and those principles. And the way that they use the spaces was a really cool way to sort of talk about how this might inform the future. And our role has been, you know, as they're looking at what the final uses and final program for the station, as well as that outdoor, the outdoor environment, our role has been to identify the formats that are possible, kind of similar to what you were saying. The stadium has a challenge of like, okay, if they know there's going to be a hotel, they know they're going to have, how do you also create the vibrancy and the integration with the community of Detroit? And they have been very thoughtful in figuring out, based on the pillars they're doing, the very local organizations, nonprofits, businesses who can be engaged. And our role has been to provide the format and identify the infrastructure that's required. So one of the things that happens is because our bread and butter of our business is working with brands that can spend $10 million on an evening. Great revenue, great ways. We see brands like that to be the 21st century patrons of the arts of community. But what you also have to do as a landlord developer is to think about the infrastructure that's required to be able to provide the 365 days of activation that you want. And so there's this push and pull. The way we like to look at it is, hey, you know, work with Skylight to think about who might be that first patron that you want to engage in the project. Give them first access to align with your goals. Then, which was the TED Climate, you know, summit. But then how do you use that initial, those dollars to reinvest in the infrastructure that you can then provide to the nonprofits that can't afford to do something, even if it's a beautiful building, if you don't have power, if you don't have the right AV, if you don't have basically chairs and things that you need. And so I think that's a really nice progression. And often when you get the big fish in to think about an initial partnership, they will also end up wanting to be engaged in a more annual or multiple times a year way. And so for us with Michigan Central, it's been a really amazing project to work with a company like Ford, but also to think about how to find the other partners who, you know, Detroit, I feel like it's been on this cusp of renaissance for decades, right? And everyone's like, is it going to get there? It's a very challenged city. You know, we can't ignore that. But I think the beauty of the Michigan Central project is it does provide this inclusive and thoughtful way of revitalizing an iconic building with the resources to provide that to then allow the community and the soul of Detroit to come back to where, you know, it once was. You think of the 1950s, right? And what Michigan Central was the larger United States of America. History is, you know,
That's at the core.
It's at the core always.
So you've done some great buildings. Is there a building, a place that you would love to activate, that you would love to work on, that you haven't?
Yes. Maybe it's not a building, but we have worked and had conversations with the National Park Services for many, many years, and we've identified certain areas. I have been always attracted to this kind of moment where the natural environment and the built environment can come together, and how to do that in ways that provide ultimate flexibility. And so that the national parks, there's absolutely a desire to figure out how to do what we do in a thoughtful way there. We also have looked at ghost towns. That is something where for us to think beyond just, you know, we do think about buildings and the canvas and the neighborhood, but to actually take over a ghost town and provide that as a canvas, that is a dream.
That's incredible. How many ghost towns are there? Is it like there are really ghost towns?
There are ghost towns. I don't know how many there are, but we've looked at maybe two or three in the US, other out like other island. There's a lot we need to hone in on what the actual criteria would be for us. But I do see value in that. I think there's a seismic change happening in terms of companies, brands, people's relationship to real estate. And so I think there's really an opportunity to be able to take something over like that and fund it through activation.
That should be the next thesis-driven deep dive. List of ghost towns.
Yes.
There we go. So last question before we move into the lightning round. I want to pivot a moment and talk about lessons for policymakers, people in government who are thinking about how do we reactivate these central business districts from a policy standpoint, from an economic development standpoint. What advice would you have for them?
Make it easier.
How so?
The challenge of permitting and different departments not speaking the same language. Like, we credit ourselves as pioneering the temporary place of assembly permit in New York. You know, back in 2008, the fire department did not talk to the Department of Buildings, did not talk to planning, did not talk to the police department. There are many different rules and regulations that come with how a building's zoned, what you can do in a temporary capacity, why, what. And for us, life safety has always been primary, given the types of environments we work in. But the permitting process is one of the reasons I think we've built the business we have, because it's complicated, it's challenging, it's all about finding the right relationships and connecting the dots. And even we work with large developers, often they'll use Skylight as the connective tissue because there's different biases based on, you know, different objectives of what's happening. So I think making it easier, but also providing a clear process and one that can actually be followed that connects the right departments to be able to say yes. I think that the toughest thing with temporary is that you don't have a 20-year horizon to make back your dollar. So it's a very condensed and concentrated period of time to figure it all out. And yet they're spending a lot of money, and it can create incredible shift in the perception. But when it's too hard or confusing, you know, it's often that there's confusion around who can say yes to what and who trumps who. And that's been a lot of our role, is to figure out that permitting process. And that's why a lot of brands trust us. And I think our name as Skylight carries a certain reputation, because as a brand, you can't commit to spending, you know, a significant budget if you don't know that you can achieve it.
Right.
And I think that's the biggest challenge with a lot of the temporary activation, is the red tape and the confusion.
Well said. And it's something you hear time and time again, talking to real practitioners who are out there doing things with cities. Their advice for cities is nothing high and complex. Just make it easier. Like, here's these tactical things we need.
Because a lot of, I think, urban planning or even marketing firms, like, there's so much beauty in like the theoretical narrative of what is possible, but the implementation, that's where Skylight sits, is like, how do you actually implement these ideas, theories, opportunities? That's where you get stuck.
Thank you. So let's move to the lightning round. These are kind of quick questions that we ask all of our guests. Quick answers, and that'll be it. So first, are we ready to go?
I'm ready.
First lightning round question. What's one piece of advice you would give a real estate developer starting off today?
Partner with your tenants. Think about how you can create collaboration and connection and service their bottom line.
What is one startup developer or entrepreneur you're watching closely today, and why?
Related, but somewhat unrelated to real estate. So Major, he is a producer, a music producer for Justin Bieber, Dr. Dre, some of these different amazing artists. And he has this podcast called Major Frequency. I think sound is something that's really undervalued in the built environment as well. Sound, all our bodies are frequency, how that can affect you emotionally, your well-being, your sense of a place, your desire to stay, dwell time, all of that's relevant to real estate. I think that sound, and thinking about some of the work that Major is doing, both from a scientific standpoint as well as in a music and how it actually affects behavior, I think that's someone to watch.
I am a big believer that sound has a lot of impacts that we don't even understand. You know, we were talking with one guest a few weeks ago, and was hearing an anecdote about how a major trading floor, you know, is a big office of a bank, pumped white noise onto their floor. And it just made everyone way more comfortable having phone calls, having conversations. But nobody realized that there was white noise being pumped onto the floor. And then one day, the machine broke. And everybody had to work from home because nobody could get any work done because it was silent.
So impactful. And those things that are totally unconscious, you're not aware of. And I think that's something
nobody had any idea. Nobody working there had any idea that there was white noise being pumped onto the floor. And then one day it wasn't there. And everyone went nuts. Little things.
Little things. And I think that's going to be very impactful in the built. To your point, that example illustrates it.
So when we're recording this podcast in the 2030s, what's the most important thing we're talking about and why?
As it relates to real estate, I think it's going to be community. I think it's going to be uses are changing. Traditional uses are no longer counted on, but people need to come together because our society is fractured without it. Isolation, still all time high. All of the ways technology and AI has blown up our worlds. I'm a firm believer in the value of it and also how to complement it with in-person. So I think there'll be conversations a lot about what are those third spaces, what replaces the history of religion and all the reasons why we've had these organizing principles as a society and what function can the built environment provide toward healing society.
This next question touches on something you were mentioning earlier around cities. But if you could, at the snap of a finger, change one real estate-related law or policy, what would it be?
Vacancy tax everywhere. I think buildings that sit empty because landlords don't care, don't need to care, I think that's the biggest blight on the built world.
Yeah, it's a negative externality.
Yeah, truly.
What is one city or place you'd bet on?
San Francisco.
Really?
I really believe it's that idea of the, you know, Sphinx rising from that. It is a beautiful city by nature. It's incredibly challenged. But I really believe in sort of the cycle and the fertile ground that all of the most challenging things are providing now for the future.
Last question. What is one new technology that you think will have the biggest impact on the built world?
Maybe an unpopular answer, but I think it's going to be the lack of technology. I think similar to how we're talking about sound and some of these things that we're not even aware of, I think technology will only continue to get greater, and I think it'll make all these experiences better. But it's only so great as it is that you're actually able to be in a space with yourself, with others, and connect. And so I think that even now we have events where people have to put their phones in a bucket or do just the presence. So I think lack of technology and creating spaces that force presence is going to be something that I predict and hope will be part of the future.
You know, I have to believe that we as humans have something, you know, fundamentally coded into us.
Yes.
That means we need to interact in person with other humans. As good as the technology gets, I still believe that that in-person interaction has to play a role. It has to.
Biologically proven. This isn't just something that you and I might, you know, pontificate about. The concept of collective effervescence, you laughed harder with others. That was one of the things that when we first designed that experience during COVID, I was like, why? You guys are blowing it out of the water. Why are you doing it? You laugh harder with someone else next to you than you do on the couch by yourself. We do exchange atoms and energy and frequency. And that is why after COVID, the stats of isolation and depression and so many things, you know, are so at an all-time high. We have to be with other people and be present when you're with other people.
Stephanie, it was an awesome conversation. So, so happy to have you on the show today. Touched on a lot of topics that I know are close to my heart and close to the audience's heart around activations, creating places, creating better places, and tapping into the stories of those places. So thank you so much for being on today.
Thank you for having me. I loved our conversation. It was an honor. Excited to continue.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed that conversation with Stephanie Blake at Skylight. And I really hope you join us next week for the final episode of season one of the Thesis Driven Leader series. We'll be joined by Charles Marone, the author of Strong Towns. And we're going to cover a wide swath of topics that we've hit on across the Leader series: innovation, technology, and the future and design of cities. Charles is, he calls himself a recovering engineer. And he got his start as civil engineer, but pretty quickly pivoted into advocating for better design of cities, design that emphasizes the needs of people over the needs of cars, and embraces a more human scale density that looks a lot like the way we designed cities back in the 19th century. So we're going to hit on a lot of topics next week in our final episode. Hope you all join us then.